This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Bartimaeus Trilogy, Book 3, Ptolemy's Gate, by Jonathan Stroud. Read for you by Simon Jones. Part 1. Alexandria, 125 BC. Bartimaeus. The assassins dropped into the palace grounds at midnight. Four fleet shadows dark against the wall. The fall was high, the ground was hard. They made no more sound on impact than the pattering of rain. 3 seconds they crouched there, low and motionless, sniffing at the air. Then away they stole, through the dark gardens, among the tamarisks and date palms, toward the quarters where the boy lay at rest. A cheetah on a chain stirred in its sleep. Far away in the desert, jackals cried. They went on pointed toe-tips, leaving no trace in the long wet grass. Their robes flitted at their backs, fragmenting their shadows into wisps and traces. What could be seen? Nothing. But leaves shifting in the breeze. What could be heard? Nothing but the wind sighing among the palm fronds. No sight, no noise. A crocodile jinni, standing sentry at the sacred pool, was undisturbed, though they passed within a scale's breadth of his tail. For humans, it wasn't badly done. The heat of the day was a memory. The air was chill. Above the palace a cold round moon shone down, slathering silver across the roofs and courtyards. This was one of the peculiarities of their sect. They acted only when the moon was full. It made their tasks more difficult, their challenge greater. And they had never failed. Aside from this, they wore only black, avoided meat, wine, women, and the playing of wind instruments, and curiously ate no cheese save that made from the milk of goats bred on their distant desert mountain. Before each job, they fasted for a day, meditated by staring unblinking at the ground, then ate small cakes of hashish and cumin seed without water until their throats glowed yellow. It's a wonder they ever killed anyone. Away beyond the wall, the great city murmured in the night. Wheels on dirt roads. Distant laughter from the pleasure district along the quay, the tide lapping at its stones. Lamplight shone in windows. Embers glowed on roof hearths, and from the top of the tower beside the harbour gate, the great watchfire burned its message out to sea. Its image danced like implight on the waves. At their posts, the guards played games of chance. In the pillared halls, the servants slept on beds of rushes. The palace gates were locked by triple bolts, each thicker than a man. No eyes were turned to the western gardens, where death came calling, secret as a scorpion, on 4 pairs of silent feet. The boy's window was on the first floor of the palace. 4 black shadows hunched beneath the wall. The leader made a signal. One by one they pressed against the stonework. One by one they began to climb, suspended by their fingertips and the nails of their big toes. All horrid and curved they were, filed sharp like eagle's talons. The assassins took good care of their feet, because of their importance in their work. They were washed frequently, rubbed with pumice, and marinated in sesame oil until the skin was soft as eiderdown. In this manner they had scaled marble columns and waterfalls of ice from Massilia to Hadramaut. The rough stone blocks were easy for them now. Up they went, like bats upon a cave wall. Moonlight glinted on bright things, gripped between their teeth. The first of the assassins reached the window ledge. He sprang tiger-like upon it and peered into the chamber. Moonlight spilled across the room. The pallet was lit as if by day. The boy lay sleeping, motionless as one already dead. His dark hair fell loose upon the cushions. His pale lamb's throat shone against the silks. The assassin took his dagger from between his teeth. With quiet deliberation he surveyed the room, gauging its extent and the possibility of traps. It was large, shadowy, empty of ostentation. Three pillars supported the ceiling. In the distance stood a door of teak, barred on the inside. A chest, half filled with clothes, sat open against the wall. He saw a royal chair draped with a discarded cloak, sandals lying on the floor, an onyx basin filled with water. A faint trace of perfume hung on the air. The assassin, for whom such scents were decadent and corrupt, wrinkled his nose. The sect avoided perfumes for practical reasons, preferring to coat themselves with scents appropriate to the conditions of each job. Pollen in the gardens, incense in the temples, sand dust in the deserts, dung and offal in the towns. They were dedicated fellows. His eyes narrowed. He reversed the dagger, holding it between finger and thumb by its shining, gleaming tip. It quivered once, twice. He was gauging the range here. He'd never missed a target yet, from Carthage to old Colchis. Every knife he'd thrown had found its throat. His wrist flickered. The silver arc of the knife's flight cut the air in two. It landed with a soft noise, hilt deep in the cushion, an inch from the child's neck. The assassin paused in doubt, still crouched upon the sill. The back of his hands bore the criss-cross scars that marked him as an adept of the Dark Academy. An adept never missed his target. The throw had been exact, precisely calibrated, yet it had missed. Had the victim moved a crucial fraction? Impossible. The boy was fast asleep. From his person he pulled a second dagger. I won't say where he pulled it from. Let's just say that the knife had hygiene issues as well as being quite sharp. Another careful aim. The assassin was conscious of his brothers behind and below him on the wall. He felt the grim weight of their impatience. Flick of the wrist, a momentary arc. With a soft noise, the second dagger landed in the cushion, an inch to the other side of the prince's neck. As he slept, perhaps he dreamed. A smile twitched ghost-like at the corners of his mouth. Behind the black gauze of the scarf that masked his face, the assassin frowned. From within his tunic he drew a strip of fabric, twined tightly into a cord. In 7 years since the hermit had ordered his first kill, his garrote had never snapped, his hands had never failed him. The hermit of the mountain trained his followers in numerous methods of foolproof murder. They could use garrotes, swords, knives, batons, ropes, poisons, discs, bowlers, pellets, and arrows inimitably, as well as being pretty handy with the evil eye. Death by fingertip and toe flex was also taught, and the furtive nip was a specialty. Stomach threads and tapeworms were available for advanced students. And the best of it was that it was all guilt-free. Each assassination was justified and condoned by a powerful religious disregard for the sanctity of other people's lives. With leopard stealth, he slid from the sill and stole across the moonlit floor. In his bed, the boy murmured something. He stirred beneath his sheet. The assassin froze rigid, a black statue in the center of the room. Behind, at the window, two of his companions insinuated themselves upon the sill. They waited, watching. The boy gave a little sigh and fell silent once more. He lay face up among his cushions, a dagger's hilt protruding on either side. 7 seconds passed. The assassin moved again. He stole around behind the cushions, looping the ends of the cord around his hands. Now he was directly above the child. He bent swiftly, set the cord upon the sleeping throat. The boy's eyes opened. He reached up a hand, grasped the assassin's left wrist, and without exertion swung him headfirst into the nearest wall, snapping his neck like a reed stalk. He flung off his silken sheet and with a bound stood free, facing the window. Up on the sill, silhouetted against the moon, two assassins hissed like rock snakes. Their comrade's death was an affront to their collective pride. One plucked from his robe a pipe of bone. From a cavity between his teeth, he sucked a pellet, eggshell thin, filled with poison. He set the pipe to his lips, blew once. The pellet shot across the room, directed at the child's heart. The boy gave a skip. The pellet shattered against a pillar, spattering it with liquid. A plume of green vapour drizzled through the air. The two assassins leapt into the room. One this way, the other that. Each now held a scimitar in his hand. They spun them in complex flourishes about their heads, dark eyes scanning the room. The boy was gone. The room was still. Green poison nibbled at the pillar. The stones fizzed with it. Never once in 7 years, from Antioch to Pergamum, had these assassins lost a victim. And they didn't intend to start now. The hermit was known to be pretty sniffy about disciples who returned in failure. There was a wall of the Institute, layered with their skins, an ingenious display which encouraged vigour in his students, as well as nicely keeping out the draughts. Their arms stopped moving. They slowed their pace, listening intently, tasting the air for the taint of fear. From behind a pillar in the centre of the room came the faintest scuffling, like a mouse flinching in its bed of straw. The assassins glanced at each other. They inched forward, toe-tip by toe-tip, scimitars raised. One went to the right, past the crumpled body of his fellow. One went to the left, beside the golden chair, draped with the cloak of kings. They moved like ghosts around the margins of the room, circling in upon the pillar from both sides. Behind the pillar, a furtive movement. A boy's shape hiding in the shadows. Both assassins saw it. Both raised their scimitars and darted in, from left, from right. Both struck with mantis speed. A dual cry, gargling and ragged. From round the pillar came a stumbling, rolling mess of arms and legs. The two assassins locked together in a tight embrace, each one skewered on the other's sword. They fell forward into the pool of moonlight in the centre of the chamber, twitched gently, and lay quiet. Silence. The windowsill hung vacant, nothing in it but the moon. A cloud passed across the bright round disk, blacking out the bodies on the floor. The signal fire in the harbour tower cast faint redness on the sky. All was still. The cloud drifted out to sea, the light returned. From behind the pillar walked the boy, bare feet soundless on the floor, his body stiff and wary, as if he sensed a pressure in the room. With careful steps he neared the window. Slowly, slowly. Closer, closer. He saw the shrouded mass of gardens, the trees and sentry towers. He noticed the texture of the sill, the way the moonlight caught its contours. Closer. Now his hands rested on the stone itself. He leaned forward to look down into the courtyard at the bottom of the wall. His thin white throat extended out. Nothing. The courtyard was empty. The wall below was sheer and smooth, its stones picked out by moonlight. The boy listened to the quietness. He tapped his fingers on the sill, shrugged, and turned inside. Then the fourth assassin, clinging like a thin black spider to the stones above the window, dropped down behind him. His feet made the noise of feathers falling into snow. The boy heard. He twisted, turned. A knife flashed, swiped, was deflected by a desperate hand, its edge clinked against stone. Iron fingers grappled at the boy's neck. His legs were knocked from under him. He fell, landing hard upon the floor. The assassin's weight was on him. His hands were pinioned. He could not move. The knife descended. This time it met its mark. So it had finished as it must. Crouching above the body of the boy, the assassin allowed himself a breath, his first since his colleagues had met their ends. He sat back on his sinewy haunches, loosened his grip upon the knife, and let the boy's wrist drop free. He inclined his head, in the traditional mark of respect, to the fallen victim. At which point, the boy reached up and plucked the knife from the centre of his chest. The assassin blinked in consternation. "Not silver, you see," the boy said. "Mistake." He raised his hand. an explosion in the room. Green sparks cascaded from the window. The boy rose to his feet and tossed the knife upon the pallet. He adjusted his kilt and blew some flakes of ash from his arms. Then he coughed loudly. The faintest of scrapings. Across the room the golden chair shifted. The cloak draped over it was nudged aside. Out from between its legs scrambled another boy, identical to the first, though flushed and tousled from many hours of hiding. He stood over the bodies of the assassins, breathing hard. Then he stared up at the ceiling. On it was the blackened outline of a man. It had a kind of startled look. The boy lowered his gaze to the impassive doppelganger watching him across the moonlit room. I gave a mock salute. Ptolemy brushed the dark hair from his eyes and bowed. "Thank you, Reckitt," he said. Chapter 1. Bartimaeus. Times change. Once, long ago, I was second to none. I could whirl through the air on a wisp of cloud and churn up dust storms with my passing. I could slice through mountains, raise castles on pillars of glass, fell forests with a single breath. I carved temples from the sinews of the earth and led armies against the legions of the dead, so that the harpers of a dozen lands played music in my memory and the chroniclers of a dozen centuries scribbled down my exploits. Yes, I was Bartimaeus. Cheetah quick, strong as a bull elephant, deadly as a striking crate. But that was then. And now? Well, right now, I was lying in the middle of a midnight road, flat on my back, and getting flatter. Why? Because on top of me was an upturned building. Its weight bore down. Muscles strained, tendons popped. Try as I might, I could not push free. In principle, there's nothing shameful about struggling when a building falls upon you. I've had such problems before. It's part of the job description. There was the time when a small section of Khufu's Great Pyramid collapsed upon me one moonless night during the 15th year of its construction. I was guarding the zone that my group was working on when several limestone blocks tumbled down from the top, transfixing me painfully by one of my extremities. Exactly how it happened was never resolved, though my suspicions were directed at my old chum Fakwal, who was working with a rival group on the opposite side. I made no outward complaint, but bided my time while my essence healed. Later, when Fakwal was returning across the western desert with some Nubian gold, I invoked a mild sandstorm, causing him to lose the treasure and incur the pharaoh's wrath. It took him a couple of years to sift all the pieces from the dunes. But it does help if the edifice in question is glamorous and large. And in this case, the fearsome construction that had been ripped from its foundations and hurled upon me from a great height was neither big nor sumptuous. It wasn't a temple wall or a granite obelisk. It wasn't the marbled roof of an emperor's palace. No. The object that was pinning me haplessly to the ground, like a butterfly on a collector's tray, was of 20th-century origin and a very specific function. Oh, all right. It was a public lavatory. Quite sizable, mind, but even so. I was glad no harpers or chroniclers happened to be passing. In mitigation, I must report that the lavatory in question had concrete walls and a very thick iron roof, the cruel aura of which helped weaken my already feeble limbs. And there were doubtless various pipes and cisterns and desperately heavy taps inside, all adding to the total mass. But it was still a pretty poor show for a jinni of my stature to be squashed by it. In fact, the abject humiliation bothered me more than the crushing weight. All around me the water from the snapped and broken pipework trickled away mournfully into the gutters. Only my head projected free of one of the concrete walls. My body was entirely trapped. The obvious solution would have been to change form into a wraith, say, or a swirl of smoke, and just drift clear. But there were two problems. One, I found it hard to change shape these days. Very hard, even at the best of times. Two, the considerable downward pressure would have blown my essence apart the moment I softened it to make the change. So much for the negatives. The good side was that I was unable to rejoin the battle that was taking place up and down the suburban street. It was a fairly low-key sort of battle, especially on the first plane. Nothing much could be seen. The house lights were all out. The electric street lamps had been tied in knots. The road was dark as an inkstone, a solid slab of black. A few stars shone coldly overhead. Once or twice, indistinct blue-green lights appeared and faded like explosions far off underwater. Things hotted up on the second plane, where two rival flocks of birds could be seen wheeling and swooping at each other, buffeting savagely with wings, beaks, claws, and tails. Such loutish behaviour would have been reprehensible among seagulls or other down-market fowl. The fact that these were eagles made it all the more shocking. On the higher planes, the bird guises were discarded altogether, and the true shapes of the fighting djinn came into focus. Truer, anyway. At bottom, we are all alike in our seeping formlessness, but every spirit has a look that suits them, and which they use to represent themselves while on earth. Our essences are moulded into these personal shapes on the higher planes, while on the lower ones, we adopt guises that are appropriate to the given situation. Listen, I'm sure I've told you all this before. Seen from this perspective, the night sky was veritably awash with rushing forms, contorted shapes, and sinister activity. Fair play was entirely disregarded. I saw one spiked knee go crunching into an opponent's belly, sending him spinning away behind a chimney to recover. Disgraceful. If I'd been up there, I'd have had no truck with that. I'd have kneed him first, then stuck a wingtip in his eye, while kicking his shin for good measure. Much more effective. The techniques of these young djinn were so inefficient it pained me. But I wasn't up there. I'd been put out of action. Now, if it had been an afrit or marid who'd done the damage, I could have lived with it. But it wasn't. In fact, my conqueror was none but a third-level djinni, the kind I could normally roll up in my pocket and smoke after dinner. I could still see her now from where I lay, her nimble feminine grace rather undermined by her pig's head and the long rake she clutched in her trotters. There she was, standing on a post-box, laying left and right with such brio that the government forces, of which I was nominally a part, backed off and left her well alone. She was a formidable customer, with experience in Japan, if her kimono was anything to go by. In truth, I'd been misled by her rustic appearance, and had ambled close without upping my shield. Before I knew it, there was a piercing oink, a blur of movement, and whump! She'd left me pinned in the road, too weary to break free. Little by little, however, my side was gaining the upper hand. See! Here strode Cormac Codron, snapping off a lamppost and swinging it like a twig. There raced Hodge, loosing off a volley of poison darts. The enemy dwindled and began to adopt ever more fatalistic guises. I saw several large insects buzzing and dodging, one or two wisps twisting frantically, a couple of rats heading for the hills. Only the she-pig stubbornly maintained her original appearance. My colleagues surged forward. One beetle went down in a corkscrew cloud of smoke. A wisp was blown apart by a double detonation. The enemy fled. Even the pig realized the game was up. She leapt gracefully onto a porch, somersaulted up onto a roof, and vanished. The victorious djinn set off in hot pursuit. It was quiet in the street. Water trickled past my ears. From topknot to toes, my essence was one long ache. I gave a heartfelt sigh. "Dear me," a voice chuckled. "A damsel in distress." I should have mentioned that in contrast to all the centaurs and ogres at my side, I'd been wearing a human guise that night. It happened to be that of a girl. Slender, long dark hair, feisty expression. Not based on anybody in particular, of course. The speaker appeared around the edge of the public convenience and paused to sharpen a nail against a snaggy bit of pipe. no delicate guise for him. As usual, he was decked out as a one-eyed giant, with lumpy muscles and long blonde hair braided in a complex and faintly girly way. He wore a shapeless blue-grey smock that would have been considered hideous in a medieval fishing village.
"A poor sweet damsel, too frail to pry herself free."
The Cyclops considered one of his nails carefully. Finding it a little long, he bit at it savagely with his small, sharp teeth, and rounded it off against the pebble-dash wall of the lavatory. "Mind helping me up?" I inquired. The Cyclops looked up and down the empty road.
"Better watch out, love," he said, leaning casually on the building so that its downward pressure increased. "There's dangerous characters abroad tonight. Gin and foliots and naughty imps who might do you a mischief."
"Can it, Ascabal?" I snarled. "You know full well it's me." The Cyclops's single eye batted becomingly under its layer of mascara.
"Bartimaeus," he said in wonder. "Can it possibly be? Surely the great Bartimaeus would not be so easily snared. You must be some imp or mooler, cheekily adopting his voice, and... But no, I am wrong. It is you."
He raised his eyebrow in an affectation of shock.
"Incredible! To think the noble Bartimaeus has come to this! The master will be sorely disappointed."
I summoned my last reserves of dignity. "All masters are temporary," I replied. "All humiliations likewise. I bide my time."
"Of course, of course."
Ascobol swung his ape-like arms and did a little pirouette.
"Well spoken, Bartimaeus. You do not let your decline depress you. No matter that your great days are over, that you are now as redundant as a will of the wisp."
Will of the wisps. Small spirits who struggle to keep up with the times. Visible as flickering flames on the first plane, although revealed on others to be more like capering squid. Wisps were once employed by magicians to lure trespassers off remote paths into pits or quags. Cities changed all that. Urban wisps have now been forced into lurking over open manhole covers, to rather less effect.
"No matter that your task tomorrow is as likely to be damp dusting our master's bedroom as roaming free upon the air, you are an example to us all."
I smiled, showing my white teeth. "Ascobol," I said, "it is not I who have declined, but my adversaries. I have fought with Faqual of Sparta, with Tlaloc of Tollan, with Clever Chu of the Kalahari. Our conflicts split the earth, gouged rivers. I survived. Who is my enemy now? A knock-kneed cyclops in a skirt? When I get out from here, I don't see this new conflict lasting long." The cyclops started back as if stung.
"Such cruel threats! You should be ashamed. We are on the same side, are we not? Doubtless you have good reasons for skulking out the fight under this restroom. Being polite, I will not trouble to inquire, though I may say that you lack your normal courtesy."
2 years' continual service has worn it all away," I said. "I am left irritable and jaded, with a perpetual itch in my essence that I cannot scratch. And that makes me dangerous, as you will shortly learn. Now, for the last time, Ascobol, get this off." Well, there were a few more tuts and pouts, but my posturing had its effect. With a single shrug of his hairy shoulders, the Cyclops levered the lavatory up and off me, sending it clattering away onto the opposite pavement. A somewhat corrugated girl got unsteadily to her feet. "At last," I said. "You took your own sweet time about it." The Cyclops plucked a bit of debris from his smock.
"Sorry," he said, "but I was too busy winning the battle to help you out before. Still, all's well. Our master will be pleased. By my efforts, anyhow."
He glanced at me sidelong. Now that I was vertical, I had no intention of squabbling further. I considered the damage to the houses all around.
Not too bad. A few broken roofs, smashed windows. The skirmish had been successfully contained. "A French lot?" I asked. The Cyclops shrugged, which was some feat, given that he lacked a neck.
"Maybe. Possibly the Czechs or Spanish. Who can tell? They're all nibbling at us nowadays. Well, time presses, and I must check on the pursuit. I leave you to nurse your aches and pains, Bartimaeus. Why not try peppermint tea or a chamomile foot bath, like other geriatrics? Adieu."
The Cyclops hitched up his skirts and, with a ponderous spring, launched himself into the air. Wings appeared on his back. With great ploughing strokes he drew away. He had all the grace of a filing cabinet, but at least he'd got the energy to fly. I hadn't. Not until I'd had a breather, anyhow. The dark-haired girl crept across to a broken square of chimney in a nearby garden. Slowly, with the gasps and gingerly movements of an invalid, she slumped down into a sitting position and cupped her head in her hands. She closed her eyes. Just a brief rest. 5 minutes would do. Time passed. Dawn came. The cold stars faded in the sky.
Chapter 2. Nathaniel. As had become his custom in recent months, the great magician John Mandrake took his breakfast in his parlour, seated in the wicker chair beside the window. The heavy curtains had been carelessly drawn back. The sky beyond was grey and leaden, and a sinewy mist threaded its way between the trees of the square. The small circular table before him was carved from Lebanese cedar. When warmed by sunlight, it gave off a pleasant fragrance. But on this particular morning the wood was dark and cold. Mandrake poured coffee into his glass, removed the silver cover from his plate, and set upon his curried eggs and bacon. In a rack behind the toast and the gooseberry conserve sat a crisply folded newspaper and an envelope with a blood-red seal. Mandrake took a swig of coffee with his left hand. With his right, he flicked the newspaper open on the table. He glanced at the front page, grunted dismissively, and reached for the envelope. An ivory paper knife hung from a peg upon the rack. Flinging down his fork, Mandrake slit the envelope with one easy motion and drew out a folded parchment. He read this with care, brows puckering into a frown. Then he refolded it, stuffed it back into the envelope, and with a sigh returned to his meal. A knock at the door. With mouth half full of bacon, Mandrake gave a muffled command. The door opened silently, and a young, slim woman stepped diffidently through, a briefcase in her hand. She halted.
"I'm sorry, sir," she began. "Am I too early?"
"Not at all, Piper. Not at all." He waved her over, indicated a chair on the other side of his breakfast table. "Have you eaten?"
"Yes, sir."
She sat. She wore a dark blue skirt and jacket with a crisp white shirt. Her straight brown hair was scraped away from her forehead and clipped at the back of her head. She settled the briefcase on her lap. Mandrake speared a forkful of curried egg. "Forgive me if I keep eating," he said. "I was up until 3, responding to the latest disturbance. Kent, this time." Miss Piper nodded.
"I heard, sir. There was a memo at the Ministry. Was it contained?"
"Yes, as far as my globe could tell, at any rate. I sent a few demons down. Well, we shall see presently. What have you got for me today?" She unclipped the briefcase and drew out some papers.
"A number of proposals from the junior ministers, sir, regarding the propaganda campaigns in the outlying regions. For your approval. Some new poster ideas?"
"Let's see." He took a gulp of coffee, held out a hand. "Anything else?"
"The minutes of the last council meeting?"
"I'll read that later. Posters first." He scanned the topmost page. "Sign up to serve your country and see the world." "What's that supposed to mean?" "More like a holiday brochure than recruitment. Far too soft. Keep talking, Piper. I'm still listening."
"We've got the latest frontline reports from America, sir. I've ordered them a little.
We should be able to make another story out of the Boston siege. Stressing the heroic attempt, not the abject failure, I trust."
Balancing the papers on his knee, he smeared some gooseberry conserve upon a piece of toast. "Well, I'll try writing something later. Now then, this one's okay. Defend the mother country and make your name."
"Good.
They're suggesting a farm boy type looking manly, which is fine. But how about putting his family group, say parents and little sister, in the background looking vulnerable and admiring? Play the domestic card."
Miss Piper nodded eagerly.
"Could show his wife too, sir." "No, we're after the single ones. It's the wives who are most troublesome when they don't come back."
He crunched on his toast.
"Any other messages?" "One from Mr. Makepeace, sir. Came by imp. Wonders if you'll drop by and see him this morning." "Can't. Too busy. There'll be time later." "His imp also dropped off this flyer."
With a rueful face, Miss Piper held up a lilac-coloured paper.
"It's advertising the premiere of his play later this week. From Wapping to Westminster, it's called. The story of our Prime Minister's rise to glory. An evening we will never forget, apparently."
Mandrake gave a groan. "If only we could. Put it in the bin. We've got better things to do than discuss theatre. What else?"
"Mr. Devereux has sent a memo around, too. Owing to the troublesome times, sir, he's placed the nation's most important treasures under special guard in the vaults of Whitehall. They will remain there until he says otherwise."
Mandrake looked up then, frowning. "Treasures? Such as what?"
"He doesn't say. I wonder if it'll be—"
"It'll be the staff and the amulet and the other Grade One items." He hissed briefly through his teeth. "That's not what he should be doing, Piper. We need them used."
"Yes, sir." "There's also this from Mr. Devereux."
She brought out a slender packet. The magician eyed it grimly.
"Not another toga." "A mask, sir. For the party this evening."
With a cry, he indicated the envelope in the rack.
"I've already got the invitation. It beggars belief. The war's going badly, the Empire's teetering on the brink, and all our Prime Minister can think about is plays and parties. All right, keep it with the documents. I'll take it along. The posters seem okay."
He handed back the papers. "Maybe not snappy enough." He thought for a moment, nodded.
"Got a pen? Try Fight for Freedom and the British Way. Doesn't mean anything, but it sounds good."
Miss Piper considered it.
"I think it's rather profound, sir."
"Excellent. Then the commoners'll snap it up." He stood, dabbed his mouth with a napkin, and tossed it down upon the tray. "Well, we'd better see how the demons have been getting on."
"No, no, Piper, please. After you."
If Miss Piper regarded her employer with more than a little wide-eyed admiration, she was by no means alone among the women of the elite. John Mandrake was an attractive young man, and the scent of power hung about him, sweet and intoxicating, like honeysuckle in the evening air. He was of medium height, slender of body, and swift and confident in action. His pale, slim face presented an intriguing paradox. Combining extreme youth, he was still only 17 years old, with experience and authority. His eyes were dark and quick and serious, his forehead prematurely lined. His intellectual self-assurance, which had once perilously outstripped his other skills, had now been bolstered by a certain social poise. To peers and inferiors alike he was courteous and charming at all times, although also somewhat remote, as if distracted by an inner melancholy. Alongside the crude appetites and eccentricities of his fellow ministers, this subdued detachment attained an elegance that only added to his mystique. Mandrake wore his dark hair close in a military crop, a conscious innovation to honour the men and women still at war. It had been a successful gesture. Spies noted that among commoners he was the most popular magician. His haircut had thus been mimicked by many others, while his dark suits had likewise inspired a brief vogue. He no longer bothered with a tie. The collar of his shirt was casually unbuttoned. Mr. Mandrake was considered by his rivals to be formidably, indeed dangerously, talented. And, following his promotion to Information Minister, they responded accordingly. But each attempted assassination had been cursorily rebuffed. Gin failed to return. Booby traps rebounded on the sender. Hexes snapped and withered.
At last, tiring of this, Mandrake made a point of publicly challenging any hidden enemy to come forward and tackle him in magical combat. No one answered his call, and his standing rose higher than ever. He lived in an elegant Georgian townhouse, surrounded by other elegant Georgian townhouses, on a broad and pleasant square. It was half a mile from Whitehall, and sufficiently far from the river to escape its smell in summer. The square was a generous expanse of beech trees and shady walkways, with an open green in the centre. It was quiet and unfrequented, though never unobserved. Grey-uniformed police patrolled the perimeter by day. After dark, demons in the form of owls and nightjars flitted quietly from tree to tree. This security was due to the inhabitants of the square. It was home to several of London's greatest magicians. On the south side, Mr. Collins, the recently appointed Home Secretary, dwelt in a cream-coloured house decorated with fake pillars and buxom caryatids. To the northwest sprawled the grandiose pile of the War Minister, Mr. Mortensen, with a golden dome glinting upon the roof. John Mandrake's residence was less ostentatious. A slender, four-story building, painted buttercup yellow, it was reached by a row of white marble steps. White shutters bordered the tall windows. The rooms were soberly furnished, with delicately patterned wallpapers and Persian rugs upon the floors. The minister did not flaunt his status. He displayed few treasures in the reception rooms and employed just two human servants to keep house. He slept on the third floor in a plain, whitewashed room adjoining his library. These were his private chambers, which no one visited. On the floor below, separated from the other rooms of the house by an empty, echoing corridor lined with panels of stained wood, was Mr. Mandrake's study. Here he conducted much of his daily work. Mandrake walked along the corridor, chewing a vestige of toast. Miss Piper tripped along behind. At the end of the corridor was a solid brass door, decorated in its centre by a moulded brass face of surpassing ugliness. Its bulbous brows appeared to be melting down across the eyes. The chin and nose jutted out like nutcracker handles. The magician halted and gazed at the face with deep disapproval. "I thought I told you to stop doing that," he snapped. A thin-lipped mouth opened, the jutting chin and nose knocked together indignantly. "Do what?" "Taking on such a hideous appearance. I've just had my breakfast." A section of brow lifted, allowing an eyeball to roll forward with a squelching sound. The face looked unapologetic. "Sorry, mate," it said. "It's just my job." "Your job is to destroy anyone entering my study without authority. No more, no less." The door guard considered. "True, but I seek to preempt entry by scaring trespassers away. To my way of thinking, deterrence is more aesthetically satisfying than punishment." Mr. Mandrake snorted. "Trespassers apart, you'll likely frighten Miss Piper here to death." The face shook from side to side, a process that caused the nose to wobble alarmingly. "Not so. When she comes alone, I moderate my features. I reserve the full horror for those I consider morally vicious." "But you just looked that way to me." "The contradiction being?" Mandrake took a deep breath, passed a hand across his eyes, and gestured. The face retreated into the metal to become the faintest of outlines. The door swung open. The great magician drew himself up, and ushering Miss Piper along before him, walked into his study. It was a functional room, high, airy, and white-painted, lit by two windows looking out upon the square. It had no excess decoration. On this particular morning, thick clouds covered the sun, so Mandrake switched on the ceiling lights as he entered. Bookcases ran along the entirety of one wall, while the opposite side was bare except for a giant pinboard covered in notes and diagrams. The wooden floor was smooth and dark. Five circles were inscribed upon it, each with its own pentacle, runes, candles, and incense pots. Four of these were of a conventional size, but the fifth, nearest the window, was significantly larger. It contained within it a full-size desk, filing cabinet, and several chairs. This master circle was joined to the smaller ones by a series of precisely drawn lines and rune chains. Mandrake and Miss Piper crossed into the largest circle and sat behind the desk, spreading out their papers before them.
"Right, then. To business. Miss Piper, we will deal with the ordinary reports first. If you would activate the presence indicator?"
Miss Piper spoke a brief incantation. Instantly the candles around the perimeters of two of the smaller circles flickered into life. Wisps of smoke rose to the ceiling. In the pots beside them, flakes of incense stirred and shifted. The other two circles remained quiet.
"Purib and Fritang," Miss Piper said.
The magician nodded.
"Purib first."
He uttered a loud command. The candles in the leftmost pentacle flared with a queasy shimmering. A form appeared in the centre of the circle. It was shaped like a man, and respectfully dressed in a sober suit and dark blue tie. It nodded briefly in the direction of the desk and waited.
"Remind me," Mandrake said.
Miss Piper glanced at her notes.
"Purip has been observing the response to our war pamphlets and other propaganda," she said, "watching the commoner's mood."
"Very well. Purip, what have you seen? Speak."
The demon bowed slightly.
"There is not much new to report. The people are like a herd of Ganges meadow cattle, half-starved but complacent, unused to change or independent thought. Yet the war presses on their minds, and I believe discontent is spreading. They read your pamphlets just as they buy your newspapers, but they do so without pleasure. It does not satisfy them."
The magician scowled.
"How is this discontent expressed?"
"I detect it in the careful blankness of their features when your police draw near. I see it in the hardness of their eyes as they pass the recruitment booths. I watch it pile up silently with the flowers at the doors of the bereaved. Most will not declare it openly, but their anger at the war and at their government is growing."
"These are just words," Mandrake said. "You give me nothing tangible."
The demon shrugged its shoulders and smiled.
"Revolution is not tangible, not to begin with. The commoners barely know the concept exists, but they breathe it when they sleep, and they taste it when they drink."
"That's enough, Riddles. Continue with your work."
The magician snapped his fingers. The demon sprang out of the circle and vanished. Mandrake shook his head.
"All but useless. Well, we'll see what Fritang has to offer."
Another command. The second circle flared into life. In a cloud of incense, a new demon appeared. A short, fat gentleman with a round red face and plaintive eyes. It stood blinking agitatedly in the artificial light.
"At last," it cried, "I have terrible news. It cannot wait another moment."
Mandrake knew Fritang of old. "As I understand it," he said slowly, "you have been patrolling the docks, hunting for spies. Does your news have anything to do with this?" A pause.
"Indirectly,"
the demon said. Mandrake sighed. "Go on, then."
"I was carrying out your orders," Fritang said, "when, oh, how the memory appalls me, my cover was blown. Here is my account. I had been conducting inquiries in a wine shop. As I exited, I found myself surrounded by a tribe of street urchins, some scarcely taller than my knee. I was disguised as a manservant, going about my quiet business. I had made no loud noises or extravagant gestures. Nevertheless, I was singled out and hit by 15 eggs, mostly thrown with force."
"What was your exact guise? Perhaps that was itself a provocation."
"I was as you see me, grey-haired, sober, and straight-backed, the model of tedious virtue. Evidently the young scoundrels decided to waylay a man of such qualities. You were unlucky, that is all."
Fritang's eyes widened, and its nostrils flared.
"There was more to it than that. They knew me for what I am."
"As a demon?" Mandrake flicked skeptically at a particle of dust upon his sleeve. "How could you tell?"
"My suspicions were aroused by their repetitive chanting. Get out, get out, vile demon. We hate you and your dangling yellow crest."
"Really? That is interesting."
The magician appraised Fritang carefully through his lenses. "But what yellow crest is this? I don't see it." The demon pointed at a space above its head.
"That is because you cannot see the sixth or seventh planes. On those my crest is self-evident, resplendent as a sunflower. I may add that it is not dangling, though captivity does make it droop a little."
"The sixth and seventh planes?
And you're quite sure you didn't let your guys slip for a moment?
Yes, yes.
Mandrake held up a hasty hand as the demon began a vehement protest.
I'm sure you're right, and I'm grateful for the information.
You will doubtless want to rest after your egg trauma. Be gone. You are dismissed. With a yell of delight, Fritang departed in corkscrew motion through the centre of the pentacle, as if sucked noisily down a plug hole. Mandrake and Miss Piper looked at each other.
Another case, Miss Piper said. Children again.
The magician leaned back in his chair and stretched his arms out behind his head.
You might just check the files, get the exact number.
I must summon the demons back from Kent. He sat forward, his elbows on the desk, and made the incantation in an undertone. Miss Piper got up and crossed to the filing cabinet on the edge of the circle. She opened the topmost drawer and drew out a bulging manila file. Returning to her seat, she removed the elastic around the file and began sifting rapidly through the documents within. The incantation ended amid a suffusion of jasmine and sweetbriar. In the right-hand pentacle a hulking form appeared, a giant with blonde braided hair and a single glaring eye. Miss Piper went on reading. The giant performed a low and complex bow.
"Master, I greet you with the blood of your enemies, with their cries and lamentations. Victory is ours."
Mandrake raised an eyebrow.
"So you chased them away, then?"
The Cyclops nodded.
"They fled like mice before lions. Literally, in some cases."
"Indeed. That was to be expected. But did you capture any?"
"We killed a good many. You should have heard them squeak, and their fleeing hooves fairly shook the earth."
"Right. So you didn't capture a single one, which was expressly what I ordered you and the others to do."
Mandrake rapped his fingers on the table. "In a matter of days they will attack again. Who sent them? Prague? Paris? America? Without captives, it is impossible to say. We are no further forward." The Cyclops gave a crisp salute.
"Well, my work is done. I am pleased to have given satisfaction."
It paused.
"You seem lost in thought, O Master."
The magician nodded.
"I am debating, Ascabol, whether to subject you to the stifles or the unfortunate hug. Do you have a preference?"
"You could not be so cruel."
The Cyclops wiggled agonizedly back and forth, toying with a braid of hair.
"Blame Bartimaeus, not me. Once again he took no useful part in the action, but was waylaid by a single blow. I was delayed from the chase by his loud requests to help him out from beneath a pebble. He is as weak as a tadpole and vicious with it. You should subject him to the stipples forthwith."
"And where is Bartimaeus now?" The Cyclops gave a pout.
"I know not. Possibly he has expired from exhaustion in the interim. He took no part in the chase."
The magician sighed deeply. "Ascabol, be gone from here." He made a dismissive sign. The giant's fluting cries of thanks were abruptly cut off. It vanished in a gout of flame. Mandrake turned to his assistant.
"Any joy, Piper?"
She nodded.
"These are the unauthorized demon sightings of the last 6 months. But when you look at the commoners..."
She glanced down at the open file.
"Most are children, and most of those children are young. In 30 cases, the witnesses were under 18.
"What's that?"
70% or so. And in over half of those, the witnesses were under 12.
She looked up.
"They're being born with it, with the power to see."
"And who knows what else?" Mandrake swiveled his chair and stared out over the bare grey branches of the trees in the square. Mists still meandered around them, cloaking the ground from view.
"All right," he said. "That's enough for now. It's nearly 9, and I've private work to do. Thanks for your help, Piper.
I'll see you at the Ministry later this morning. Don't let that door guard give you any cheek as you go out." For some moments after his assistant's departure, the magician remained motionless, tapping his fingers together aimlessly. Finally, he leaned over and opened a side drawer in his desk. He pulled out a small cloth bundle and set it down in front of him. Flicking the fabric aside, he revealed a bronze disc,
shiny with the use of years. The magician stared down into the scrying glass, willing it into life. Something stirred in its depths.
"Fetch Bartimaeus," he said.
Chapter 3. Bartimaeus.
With dawn, the first people returned to the little town. Hesitant, fearful, groping their way like blind men up the street, they began to inspect the damage wrought to their houses, shops, and gardens. A few night police came with them, ostentatiously flourishing inferno sticks and other weapons, though the threat was long since gone. I was disinclined to move. I spun a concealment around the chunk of chimney where I sat, and removed myself from the human sight. I watched them passing with a baleful eye. My few hours' rest had done me little good. How could it? It had been 2 whole years since I'd been allowed to leave this cursed earth. 2 full years since I'd last escaped the brainless thronging mass of sweet humanity. I needed more than a quiet kip on a chimney stack to deal with that, I can tell you. I needed to go home. And if I didn't, I was going to die. It is technically possible for a spirit to remain indefinitely on Earth, and many of us at one time or another have endured prolonged visits, usually courtesy of being forcibly trapped inside canopic jars, sandalwood boxes, or other arbitrary spaces chosen by our cruel masters. When goaded into invoking the spell of indefinite confinement, magicians usually compress the spirit into the first object they spy close at hand. I once cheeked a master a little too cleverly during his afternoon tea. Before I knew it, I was imprisoned inside a half-filled pot of strawberry jam, and would have remained there, possibly for all eternity, had not his apprentice opened it by mistake at supper that same evening. Even so, my essence was infested with sticky little seeds for ages after. Dreadful punishment, though this is, it at least has the advantage of being safe and quiet. You aren't called upon to do anything, so your increasingly weakened essence is not immediately at risk. The main threat comes from the remorseless tedium, which can lead to insanity in the spirit in question. The Afrit Honorius was a case in point. He went mad after 100 years' confinement in a skeleton. A rather poor show. I like to think with my engaging personality I could keep myself entertained a little longer than that. My current predicament was in stark contrast. Not for me the luxury of being hidden away in a cosy lamp or amulet. No, day in, day out, I was a jinni on the street, ducking, diving, taking risks, exposing myself to danger. And each day it became a little more difficult to survive. For I was no longer the carefree Bartimaeus of old. My essence was raddled with Earth's corruption, my mind was bleary with the pain. I was slower, weaker, distracted from my tasks. I found it hard to change form. In battle my attacks were sputtering and weak. My detonations had the explosive power of lemonade. My convulsions trembled like jelly in a breeze. All my strength had gone. Where once, in the previous night's scrap, I would have sent that public convenience right back at the Sheepig, adding a phone box and a bus stop for good measure, now I could do nothing to resist. I was vulnerable as a kitten. A few small buildings in the face I could stand, but already I was practically at the mercy of second-rate fops such as Ascobol, a fool with no great history to speak of. And if I met a foe with even a grain of power, my luck would surely end. It is a curious fact that despite our fury at being summoned into this world, spirits such as I derive a good deal of retrospective satisfaction from our exploits. At the time, of course, we do our darndest to avoid them, but afterward we often display a certain weary pride in the cleverest, bravest, or most jammy events on our resume. Philosophers might speculate this is because we are essentially defined by our experiences in this world, since in the other place we are not so easily individualized. Thus those with long and glittering careers, e.g. me, tend to look down on those, e.g. Ascobol, whose names have been unearthed more recently and haven't amassed so many fine achievements. In Ascobol's case I also disliked him for his silly falsetto voice, which ill becomes an 8-foot cyclops.
A weak Jinni is a bad slave. Bad twice over, since he is both ineffective and a laughingstock. It does a magician no favours to maintain one in the world. This is the reason why they usually